This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio here on NPR One.
I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer reporting from Bristol, Tennessee. Making moonshine has been a part of the culture of Appalachia since the first Scots-Irish immigrants settled here in the late 1700s. Tim Nichols' family has been making shine forever.
My granddad's grandfather, he had a still, and of course, my grandfather had his still that I helped him on, and now I have mine. So it's been passed down through the years.
It's actually legal to make moonshine as long as you don't offer it for sale. When Nichols decided to ramp up their family distilling operation following his successful career as a NASCAR race driver, he and his sons decided to go above board and start a bonded distilling operation. Before they even opened their doors to the public, Nichols Appalachian Heritage Vodka stole the show at the 2018 Denver Spirits Competition, claiming best in class and best overall. The advent of NASCAR actually commenced with moonshiners, who modified their delivery vehicles with high-powered engines to evade the cops and revenue agents when delivering their goods by the light of the moon. One thing led to another, and before long the drivers' competitive spirits led them to challenge one another to races. And it was the formalization of their rules of the race that led to the creation of NASCAR in Daytona Beach, Florida in 1948. Today, the Bristol Motor Speedway in Bristol, Tennessee touts the fastest and steepest half mile of all NASCAR tracks, with seating for 160,000 fans, twice that of a Super Bowl stadium. Bristol is fondly dubbed the Coliseum, where fights complete with helmet throws are part of the attraction.
Tim Nichols, we're in Bristol, Tennessee, and our distillery is Appalachian Heritage Distillery, and we make volunteer vodka.
So this is a new incarnation for your life, yet familial-wise, it goes way back generations making moonshine.
Yeah, my family's all from up in Buchanan County, Virginia, and it sits in the corner where West Virginia and Kentucky and Virginia meet on the Tug River. So I grew up in that area, and we lived on the Virginia side, and actually my first job was in coal mine in Colwood, West Virginia, over in McDowell County when I was 16.
Making whiskey, distilling has been a part of your life, right? And your family's life going back generations.
Yes, it has. Far back as I know was my granddad's grandfather. His name was Lark Justice. He had a still, and of course, my grandfather had his still that I helped him on, and now I have mine. So it's been passed down through the years.
Back in the day, being a moonshiner was just a part of the culture of the community.
Well, yeah, in our community, they were three, and all three had their own little following. The funny thing about it, my wife's grandfather was the other one in our community. So my son's got it on both sides.
You can homebrew, you know, you can make X amount of alcoholic product, right?
Well, the ATF has rules on it. What I was told back in the day, if you don't sell it, we ain't worried about you. Now, when you start selling it, that's where you run into the problem.
We're here in Tennessee, the heartland. Whiskey and spirits has been a part of the culture since the Scots-Irish came over.
And, you know, that was our family, Scotch-Irish, And it was funny moving from up in Buchanan County. And like I said, I worked all through Pike County, Kentucky, and over in McDowell County. Moving from that part of the world down here a few years ago and talking to some of the people down here, it's amazing. 2-3 hours away, and they were doing exactly the same thing. They had the same methods, you know, the same ways.
And yet never communicated with each other.
No, you know, had not a clue who each other was.
Well, we were talking earlier about the Scots and their swan neck distillation pots. There they are here in the new country.
Yes, they are, and I really looked hard at it. And I imagine the vodka keeps going as well as it is. That will probably be my next purchase because I really like pot-stilled alcohol. It has its own flavor, it's own beast. It ain't mass-produced. You know, the Scotch, Irish, you know, they've known this for years. You go to Scotland, Ireland. My daughter just come back from Ireland and brought some nice whiskey back from Cork. And it's just funny, the characteristics in it is the same characteristics we have here that we look for in ours.
Well, let's talk about the big picture. You hear about bourbon, Tennessee bourbon, Kentucky bourbon, you know, all these nuances. You know, what defines and delineates one whiskey or one bourbon from the other? You know, what makes one what it is?
The mash bill, you have to be 51% corn to be bourbon, pretty much the same as Tennessee. Then after the 51% use barley, you can use rye, you know, several things that you can put in to make up the mash bill. And, you know, the biggest thing to be bourbon, you need to be in a new white oak barrel.
And is there an aging time limitation?
4 years is what I've always been told and what I've seen. I've seen some bourbon now out in a bottle, it's got 2 years on it.
But it's kind of violating what the true definition is, right?
Yes, I feel that way. I'm more of a purist when it comes to that stuff. Just like on the Tennessee whiskey, the Lincoln County method of charcoal filtering, I think is the primary thing in Tennessee whiskey. You've got that nice smoky charcoal taste in it. And, you know, some bourbons have that, but most bourbons have a sweet, earthy finish. And the Tennessee whiskey has more of a smoky finish. Like I said, they've kind of changed on, you know, as long as it's charcoal filtering now. I'm a big fan of the New Zealand charcoal.
I was going to say, you like charcoal filtering no matter what.
Yes,
right?
I do.
Yeah. Actually, for whatever you make.
Actually, our vodka is charcoal filtered twice.
And your vodka is extraordinarily smooth and yet flavorful, incredibly so. Is it the charcoal filtration, the double triple, that makes that?
I think it helps. I really
so
think
if you did not?
I think if I didn't, it would have more of a bite to it. I think the charcoal filtering doesn't mess with the makeup of the flavor, but it smooths the burn of the alcohol, in my opinion. And I've always filtered. My grandfather back in the day, that was one reason people really liked his shine, was he filtered it. He just was a firm believer in it.
So today there are a lot of guys that were moonshiners just by default because it's what you did culturally, and yet they've kind of gone over the legal side like you did. And yet there still are moonshiners. There still are guys that are doing it under the wire. And is that just because they don't care and it's just who they are and what they are?
I think so. I think it's a way of life. We had an old gentleman in here about a week ago that was a legendary moonshiner up in Dickinson County, Virginia. I'm not mentioning his name, and he quit. He had joined church. He's almost 80 now, but he was really amazed with how we had it set up. And his whole deal was, he said, you know, I felt like I was legal. You know, I was making a living for my family, and the government shouldn't have messed with what I'm doing. They had no part in this, so why should I give them money? And I just kind of stood and smiled and listened to him. And the reason I'm legal to this day is those two young man in there said, Dad, we're going to do this. We're going to do it legal. So that was that. I didn't have a choice.
But little did you know, it would balloon into so quickly a super successful operation. I mean, the boys were telling me about winning like this double gold.
Yeah.
And you're right, new out of the show. And this was in, what, Denver, Colorado?
Yeah, we hadn't even opened the doors on the distillery. We just got our license and all this stuff, and the boys had a magazine in there, and they go, hey, look here, Denver International Spirit Competition, all the big boys are there. I said, you know, let's put a bottle in. And I said, well, you know, why not, you know?
So there are guys in Denver, they're going, Appalachian Heritage who?
Yeah, right. Pretty much. Yeah. Well, it was real funny. After we had won, they called and told us we had won our class, and then won best overall vodka. Like, the next week, we were Googled, like, 1,000 times. It was kind of funny.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
People, you know, where is this
guys?
Place? Yeah. Yeah, and there are two Vance drives in Bristol. One's Virginia and one's Tennessee. And they were on there, you know, I've Googled Vance Drive, Virginia, and there's no building on there like that. So it was kind of fun.
That's funny. But we're still in Tennessee, right?
Yeah, we're in Tennessee.
Right on the border.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, we're out of time. But before we go, your name again and for further information.
Well, I'm Tim Nichols. Like I said, this is Appalachian Heritage Distillery. We make volunteer vodka. Oh, before we go, let me throw this in. We're working, getting in the state of West Virginia, and I wanted to do something, you know, because that's where I'm from. up on the Tug River. We've got our label approved. We're going to be doing a really nice vodka dedicated to the state of West Virginia called Mountaineer Vodka, and it's going to be a little difference in the grape corn bill will be the difference in the two vodkas.
Tim, thanks for sharing. I really appreciate it a lot.
Okay, thank you.
Jerry Caldwell is the Executive Vice President and General Manager at the Bristol Motor Speedway.
You know, I'm blessed to be able to work here. I've been here for a little over 20 years. Did an internship here 22 years ago. Just fell in love with the excitement, the energy, the chaos of it all. I just love it.
Bristol Motor Speedway really is unique in all of America.
It really is. There's nothing else like it that we've seen in the world. It's the largest coliseum that you'll find in the country. It's completely bowled in, 160,000 seats almost, depending on how we set it up. Put 40 cars in there and get them going 130 miles an hour and you really get some excitement.
And coliseum, okay, / gladiators. I tell people all the time about Bristol and the gladiators and why people come, and that's one of the reasons.
It really is. You know, you pack all those folks into this facility, you put those drivers in there, and it's like the last great Coliseum, like we call it. And you're kind of just waiting for the lions to come out. It has a tendency to ramp up the tempers.
The adrenaline.
And everything else. So
the gladiator part comes in when there are wrecks and guys crash into each other.
Well, you know, it's tight quarters, so you've got a lot of people fighting for the same real estate. And when those things occur, because they're going to occur, tempers tend to flare. We've had helmets fly. We've had other things be thrown at drivers. We've had fights break out.
Helmet to helmet clashes. Yeah.
Helmet to car clashes sometimes. Yeah.
But it still blows my mind. I mean, 150,000, 160,000 people coming here packing and just all ardent fans.
Yeah, I mean, if you go to a major concert and you see 30 or 40,000 people and you think, wow, that's a lot of people. And then you think, put four times that many in here for either a race or a football game or others, and they come from all over the world. Last year we had people from all 50 states and 26 different countries coming to the races.
And then there's that on-scene, behind-the-scenes dynamic, the logistics, feeding them and navigating and just the cars getting in and out and not waiting in line forever. I mean, that's an art in itself.
It really is. You know, just feeding people is quite the undertaking. You think about a Super Bowl. The Super Bowl is going to be 85, 90,000 people. So you double that. You've got to feed all these folks. We are blessed with some great relationships here locally in Northeast Tennessee and Southwest Virginia with first responders and traffic management individuals, and they do an amazing job of getting the people in and out of here. We have people come from all over the country just to study how we do it.
Which is an art.
It really is an art.
And you realize it's an art when you go someplace where it sucks.
Yeah. Well, and we're a little bit of David versus Goliath. You know, we're a big fish in a small pond. But we love it that way. Yeah. You know, we love this region, the people that embrace the things that we have going on here. There's just a natural hospitality about the people in this region and the beauty of this region that makes it a really special place that just can't be replicated.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's reel back in time. Early days, 20th century, Prohibition and the moonshiners and how they, in many respects, are the ancestors, the birthing of NASCAR. Tell us that story. That's really
absolutely
good. And right here in Tennessee.
Absolutely. I mean, you can kind of feel it, can't you, just even being here. Those are the roots of our sport. You really had a lot of moonshiners and guys running illegal product in the hills.
As fast as they could.
And, of course, that's going to result in people saying, my car's faster than yours. And NASCAR kind of was birthed out of that with, let's put those cars on the track and let's see who's the fastest and who can go the longest.
And was that the whole region, wasn't it?
It really was. It was kind of all over that place. You had the likes of Junior Johnson and those over in the North Carolina mountains really started on the beaches in Daytona. So you really got the concentration of Tennessee, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, and
all
down into Florida.
Down. Yeah, interesting. Okay, so when did this morph and become NASCAR Racetrack and the Bristol Motor Speedway?
Well, it was built in 1961, but it really started from a vision from a few men who saw...
These were local boys?
These were local guys. Mm-hmm. The interesting part of that story is they caught the vision from a gentleman named Bruton Smith, who was building Charlotte Motor Speedway at the time in the early 60s, late 50s in Charlotte. They heard about what was going on over there. They went to see it. Came back over here and decided they ought to do that in Bristol, Tennessee.
And he's still around, right?
And he ends up buying the racetrack from them in 1996 and really turns it into the last great Coliseum that you see today. Is credited with modernizing our sport from a facility standpoint.
And the other thing that I find fascinating, and this becomes a year-round destination even when the guys aren't racing.
Well, what has happened is we'll always be a racetrack. It's in our DNA. It's who we are. But we've really turned into a sports and entertainment venue. So we have something going on over 300 days out of the year here. And as you saw a couple of years ago, hosted the world's largest football game. And
that was Tennessee versus, what was it,
Virginia Tech.
Yes. Yeah. 150-some thousand?
Yeah, 157,000 people showed up for that. It was quite the event, a special thing to be a part of.
Now, are you going to do a reprise? Is that something to do it again?
Yeah, we're having a lot of conversations to be able to do that again. We don't know the teams and exactly when we're going to do it yet. But we've got a lot of good conversations going.
And then another dynamic over your shoulder is the loudest, noisiest drag strip in the world.
Yeah, that's truly Thunder Valley.
Explain why.
Well, if you come visit, you can see it. It's in a valley, and when they crank up those cars and take off down through that valley, it thunders through there, and they can hear it miles away. We've got folks that live in this area that live miles down, and they know when we're running in at the dragway. It also is a history that is just unmatched, really, in drag racing because of the NHRA days, IHRA, and all of that kind of taking place right here again with some guys having a vision and then meeting up with Bruton Smith later on and him being able to elevate that vision and modernize the facility.
Briefly touch on the inverse aspect of drag racing really started on the West Coast.
Yeah, it did. There were some pockets of it on the East Coast, but West Coast really were the roots of that. And then as it moved here, you wanted those facilities. So that was really Bristol and a few others.
But today, drag racing, I would associate more with here than even the West Coast.
Yeah, and is becoming an international sport. It's a bit more of a niche sport, but it's an exciting sport, and I think one that will continue to grow.
Okay, let's talk community and Christmas time, because that's another incredible story.
So our chairman, Bruton Smith, starts a Speedway Children's Charities chapter at each one of his racetracks. So he did that back in 1996 here, and Claudia Bird has run that ever since, and she's a tremendous lady with a tremendous passion for raising money for the kids. We do our chief fundraiser for that every year is called Speedway and Lights, and we put a 4-mile route together on our property where you get to drive by the drag strip and
so
on the
your
racetrack.
Your whole family, your family car drives around and through the racetrack.
Millions of Christmas lights, and you can pile the family in and take them through, and that's our big fundraiser for Speedway Children's Charities.
That's so cool. Well, anything you want to add, because you know all the secrets and I don't.
You've covered it all well.
I did pretty good. Huh?
Yeah, appreciate you being here so much.
There was a race going on. I don't think I could hunt you down.
Yeah, I hope you'll come back.
I'd be honored. Thanks for visiting.
Absolutely. My name is Jerry Caldwell. I'm general manager here at Bristol Motor Speedway. You can go to bristolmotorspeedway.com or give us a call at 423-989-6900.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Bristol Motor Speedway in Tennessee. We'll see you here.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. People often associate the Society of St. Vincent de Paul with thrift stores. Donations like clothing, your gently used couch, or still serviceable washing machine generate funds to assist the Society in putting food on the table for people in need, or keeping the lights on and families in their homes. To find a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in your area, visit svdpusa.org. Once again, svdpusa.org. And whether you're shopping for new or used items, donating them, or volunteering, you're helping the Society of St. Vincent de Paul help others. And the sun will